This is 89.9 WWNO New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll explore the city's nightlights with Cityscapes columnist Richard Campanella and discuss a potential fee on stormwater drainage. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. But first, in 2014, a group of eclectic musicians from Colorado, New Orleans, and Nashville came together for the first annual I Know concert in southern Uganda, performing with a cadre of talented musicians and rising stars on the East Africa music scene. More than 4,000 people turned out for the free concert, and 826 people received free HIV testing. The concept behind this free concert is simple: to create HIV awareness and prevention in communities that are sometimes very hard to reach. Joining me to talk more about the I Know concert series is Dr. Andrew Ward, Ryan Grundy, and Tom Larson. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
So tell me, what brings you to New Orleans?
So I actually, this is Andrew speaking, I actually live in New Orleans, and we are delighted to have everybody in the same room at the same time to talk about, we are opening up the applications for New Orleans artists to become a part of the HIV Awareness I Know concert series in southern Uganda.
Now, you guys are no stranger to this event. Tell us all about it.
Well, this is the fourth year of the concert, and we're excited that we've expanded to three cities this year. We bring musicians from the United States and collaborate with musicians in Uganda, put on a music festival for all the people in rural villages, and we also provide HIV testing and other health services.
Now, Ryan, you're the executive director of the Global Livingston Institute. Tell us the mission of that institute.
Yeah, so the Global Livingston Institute is really all about connecting globally minded students, community leaders, musicians, artists, folks from all around the world to take a really unique approach to international development. Instead of the more traditional approaches of going over to developing countries and building schools and painting medical clinics, we're building partnerships, we're having conversations. And the music festival in Uganda really spun out of those conversations. Mm-hmm. And so it's an exciting thing to kind of be here in New Orleans and be with the whole crew and plan an amazing year.
Yes. Talk about the role New Orleans musicians play with this festival that you guys are putting on, because a lot of the cultures, they have some similarities.
Absolutely. I mean, the music in New Orleans obviously is amazing and diverse. And the talent and the players here are, you know, second to none. So it's an ideal place to use as a pool to try to bring some of that diversity and musicality over to, you know, a developing country.
Yeah. Another similarity between the two cities actually is HIV as well. New Orleans being one of the top five cities.
Number two this year.
Yeah, that's crazy. So talk about the importance of, again, having New Orleans kind of stamping this festival in Uganda.
Excellent. So there's also GLI, Global Livingston Institute, their mantra is listen, think, act. So the idea is listen, you become aware of the problem, think, you consider various ways of tackling it, and then you act in a new and innovative way, being stakeholder driven. So we've coined this the New Orleans model of international development, because nothing in this city gets done without excellent music.
Yeah.
You could be the most lovely, wonderful person in the world, and if you die and your band isn't good at the funeral, ain't nobody going to come. So what we have managed to do is we say, look, we know what motivates people in New Orleans, music, and we know that it's culturally and linguistically appropriate to do the same thing in Uganda. Mm-hmm. So based upon our time here, we listened, we thought, and we're acting, and we're moving the point where we have a gigantic free concert all across Uganda, a series, actually three cities this year, drawing in the target population, namely at-risk youth, adolescents, and they come in and they get their free HIV testing.
Right. Now, let's point out some of the wonderful things that's going to happen at this concert. First off, it's all weekend long, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Well, absolutely. There's three concerts this year. And Lira, Masaka, and Kibali, which are in three different areas of Uganda. And it's a full, two of them are on a Saturday. I think one of them's on a Wednesday this year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a full concert from traditional acts, local traditional acts, to hip hop artists, to collaborations with the U.S. artists. There's skits, there's plays, there's all sorts of stuff that goes on for about 7 or 8 hours.
Right, each time. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's gospel and there's, you know, kids dancing troupes and all the rest. I mean, so much of this was inspired by daily life, and especially during festival and carnival season here in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and saying, can we replicate that? And the answer was a resounding yes. I mean, the day before the festival, we second line through mm-hmm. the streets of rural Uganda.
Wow.
We have a full brass section. We play When the Saints Go Marching In. We throw condoms and beads from the stage.
Wow.
150,000 condoms last year.
Wow. Okay, Tom, so you're the musical director of the festival. Can we expect any original music from you guys?
We will be doing some original music, but one of the tunes that we're about to hear is something that New Orleans knows and is dear to its heart. And it was special for us that we could bring a piece of New Orleans to Uganda and teach it to them. And nothing said that better than recording in a back alley of Kabale with a little power generator and teaching them how to play When the Saints Go Marching In.
So. Yeah, so that's what we're hearing.
That's what you're about to hear.
And that flute is eternal. When you hear a nice traditional African flute.
Mm-hmm. Teaching them how to do a melody. He got pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. So first off, how do musicians get in contact with you to get signed up? And when is this concert happening?
This year is in September.
Okay.
So they can get on www.iknowconcertseries.org. And that brings them to the homepage for the festival. And there they can get in contact with us and let us know how they want to get involved. And it's not just musicians. You can request to come, you know, if you're just want to come and help out and volunteer with the festival, or if you want to perform on the festival. Everything will have to get screened by us and figure out who's the right fit to really be a great partner on this. But we'd like to open it up to have more people.
Are there any other things that we need to address about this festival that's happening in September?
Absolutely. So much of this is inspired by daily life in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. If you want to see what New Orleans looks like in Uganda and the beautiful synchronicity that comes from the local ethno-linguistic traditions mixed with 300 years of New Orleans, you can see it, you can hear it, you can taste it, you can smell it, you can feel it. It's one of the most beautiful, vibrant, and celebratory events of the year.
Now, I'd imagine folks listening, we could attend, right? If we take that trip to Uganda, let's say, I mean, I have enough time.
Please do.
Our first year, we were hoping 2,000 people would come. As opposed, instead, 4,500 people came.
Wow.
We were hoping the next year, maybe we could get 1,000 people tested for HIV. 1,250 were. After doing 4 concerts over the last 3 years, we've had a total of 38,000 people attend. 7,500 have been tested for HIV, and we're thinking of doubling all of that this year, and you can be a part of it. Come on, New Orleans. Come on down.
Well, nothing else needs to be said. Tom, Ryan, Dr. Ward, thank you so much for stopping by on today. That was Dr. Andrew Ward and Tom Larson, chairman and musical director of the I Know Concert Series, along with Ryan Grundy, executive director of the Global Livingston Institute. For more information, visit iknowconcertseries.org. Every month, WWNO hears from Richard Campanella about his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. This time, the professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture explores the history of lighting up New Orleans at night with WWNO's Eve Tro.
So we're talking, as we always do, with Richard Campanella, the geographer at the Tulane School of Architecture, writes his cityscapes column for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune, each month. And this month, he is writing about a very illuminating subject, if you'll allow me that pun.
Moon towers, this spectacular short-lived experiment of urban illumination in the early days of electricity that tried to resolve an ongoing debate among engineers at the time, how best to illuminate nocturnal cityscapes. Would you do it from a decentralized system of thousands of lampposts and strung incandescent bulbs? Or was it more efficient to erect these towering steel towers with these super bright arc lamps that would illuminate entire neighborhoods from one point?
Now let's back up for a little bit. What was the initial way of illuminating the city of New Orleans?
Well, we have colonial records from Spanish times on the Cabildo that speak of a system of small oil-fueled lanterns mounted on corners. These were later replaced by 86 lanterns from Philadelphia, glass lanterns that were strung from the middle of intersections. For fuel, they got the oil wherever they could. And there's an amusing line in Cabildo records where they experimented with fish oil, bear oil, and pelican grease.
I know. I don't know that pelican grease is commercially available anymore.
I don't know if pelican meat is edible.
They switched from these gas lanterns and then... Right.
It started out as oil. That exists up until the 1830s. By then, there's a new technology afoot called gasification, where if you superheat coal, gas emanates from it, and you could pipe that out to subscribers. So we're talking like, 180 years ago, there was a gas manufacturing plant roughly where the Superdome is. And so for the next 50 years, 1830s up until the 1880s, New Orleans at night would have been thousands of little flickering gas lights indoors, outdoors, and just kind of would have this yellow glimmer at night.
And then electrification. Now, when I was reading your piece, it reminded me of perhaps the early days of the internet. It's just this new technology that then some people have, but some people don't, and everybody wants it, but how do we get it to everyone?
It was a bit of a free-for-all, and people just relished the new lighting, particularly the commercial sector. Hotels, theaters, storefronts, all the great department stores downtown. But the question of how to illuminate the actual cityscape and the port as well drew upon what other cities were doing. Aurora, Illinois, New York City had a 250-foot tower over Madison Square, now Madison Square Garden, as well as the East River. And there was a sense with the city that we could make the constituency happier faster by erecting a few towers with these gigantic lights rather than a more expensive decentralized system. So starting in the mid-1880s and lasting roughly the next 20 years, these towers went up all over town. I don't have a full count, but judging from photographs, there were at least two or three dozen. And it is almost unbelievable. These things look like erector-set dinosaurs marching up and down the grand avenues. Birds would crash into them. The lights themselves were blinding to look at. They cast hard shadows locally, and then they just kind of faded away as you got too far. So the system was just not working. They were also extremely dangerous to maintain.
Because people had to climb up into these towers as opposed to, say, just the height of a lamppost.
It was probably the most dangerous job in America 130 years ago. They would go up and they would replace these carbon electrodes, and that's what created that arc of fire. And the carbon burned out every day. So every single day, a specialist would have to climb up there, replace these electrodes, and relight them for the upcoming evening.
So the city decides it does not want to light things this way, and the towers come down.
Rather unceremoniously, it was kind of undocumented, but if you look at photographs, they start to become rarer and rarer by the 1905, 1908. And if you look at other ones, you start to see the rise of these shepherd's crook lampposts. You'll also see along Canal Street incandescent bulbs, these huge bulbs, dangling from wires, suspended over wires on Upper Royal Street. There are just dozens of them dangling from wires. So over the next generation, utility wiring in the CBD and French Quarter go underground, and you see the disappearance of the old telephone lines. And to this day, when we have a hurricane, those are the only two neighborhoods that don't lose their electricity. And in most other cases, we have the rise of the decentralized illumination system that we have today of lampposts.
Richard Campanella, this is the last Cityscapes interview I'll be doing with you. I really enjoy these conversations, and I know they will continue in some fashion on WWNO. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to serenade you. You light up my life.
I was going to sing Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans, but I will spare your listeners.
Thank you, as always.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Is a rainy, wet city. After Katrina, the Army Corps built new pumping stations and improved drainage in order to prevent flooding during storms. But there's more work to do. Federal money will pay to further improve canals and pumping stations, but the city has to contribute a percentage, and it has to pay for upkeep. The nonprofit Bureau of Governmental Research has released a new study calling for a fee on stormwater drainage to fill that gap. WWNO's Tegan Wendland talked with researcher Peter Reichard.
The city got all this money after the storm, and it's up to the city to maintain the drainage system here. But there are also more plans for federally funded projects, and the city has to pay its part for those things, too. So why did your organization look to a stormwater fee as a potential solution?
Like most BGR reports, we're trying to solve a problem. And the problem here is that we know flood protection is a top priority in New Orleans. We also know that it's underfunded. We also know that we have major responsibilities coming down the way, such as the need to provide matching funds for Corps of Engineer projects around town. And the pump stations at the lakefront need to be maintained. That's going to cost millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. We have $760 million worth of federally funded projects on the table in the future that we have to contribute to, the city does. How much does that come out to annually for the Sewage and Water Board?
It's going to take about $9 million a year to pay for their match on the federal drainage projects uptown and on Florida Avenue, plus another $5 million a year in maintenance costs, mainly for the new pump stations.
So what's the total annually then?
Well, just for that, you're looking at $14 million. But they're saying that they need a lot more than that because the city's drainage system is not being maintained at any serious level. And then the Sewage and Water Board says it needs more maintenance funds for its existing systems and capital funds for its existing systems. So as a total, they're looking at a projected $55 million
wow.
a year.
So how would a stormwater fee work? Would homeowners pay for water runoff from their properties, and how much would that be?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of ways to go about the fees, and in our report, we lay out a range of options from very crude per parcel fee approaches that aren't particularly fair or effective at incentivizing people to reduce runoff, to some overly complex approaches that we would not recommend because of the lack of transparency surrounding them. In the middle, there are good approaches that create a strong nexus between runoff and the amount of the fee and that do incentivize runoff reduction by property owners. So the small suburban home surrounded by grass would pay a lot less than a grocery store surrounded by a sea of concrete.
Do you have an estimate for what it might be for that small suburban home?
We don't. It's hard to say how much the fee would be without gathering the data needed to implement a specific type of model. And we walk through a bunch of different models, and some of them are multiple models are good. But just as a back of the napkin type thing, if you put it into a crude parcel fee, it would take $327 a year or $27 per month per parcel to generate $55 million a year. In reality, a residential property would probably pay less than that because big commercial institutional properties would end up shouldering more of the load.
Mm-hmm. This isn't uncommon. Your report says at least 39 other states have
fees like this. Yeah, and there are hundreds of stormwater utilities set up around the country. It's unusual that Louisiana, particularly given our challenges, that we don't have any of these fee structures in place, and particularly in New Orleans.
So might it be unpopular with homeowners? We kind of hate taxes here. And the last couple of times the city tried to pass a stormwater fee like this, it failed. How would it be different now?
I think people hate taxes everywhere. I don't think we're unusual in that. It's hard to say how it would be different now. I think the city and the Sewage and Water Board are going to have to come forward with a very strong structure that they can convince people is fair.
And the city has also made living with water, as it calls it, one of its goals. You know, we have this plan to cut down on water runoff by creating more green space to absorb it and to get it into the water tables instead of just pumping it out. So how does this proposal kind of align with that idea?
It aligns very nicely with it. And we had that in the back of our minds all the way through. In looking at the very structures, we wanted to create a structure that incentivizes every property owner to reduce runoff and to basically chip in on this problem.
How might that look in a practical way? Would this incentivize people, you know, creating green space on their properties and trying to create, you know, alternative drainage?
Mm-hmm. It would be take the form of things like instead of building a concrete driveway, maybe you put a combination of concrete and some pervious material. You just use a pervious material. You don't have a driveway at all because you don't want to pay for it.
So the fee would be structured based upon the amount of pervious area on that property.
Some calculation that takes that factor into account, yes.
Okay.
That's what we would recommend.
And what would need to happen for something like this to be enacted?
Well, there's kind of a mess legally. There's language both in the legislature directing a public vote, and there's also language in the city charter that is just a muddle. We talk about it in our report. And as far as we could see right now, it would have to go to a public vote. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you have to convince the public that this is in their interests.
How is the Sewerage and Water Board planning to pay for this $54 million a year now without a stormwater fee?
You'd have to ask them that. I think if you didn't have a stormwater fee, you'd end up having to proceed with a property tax increase. That, again, would go to voters, though. So they've got a challenge either way.
Thank you, Peter Reichard, Director of Research at the Bureau of Governmental Research.
Thank you, Dee.
Support for WWNO's Coastal Desk comes from the Greater New Orleans Foundation, the Koi Poo Foundation, and the Walton Family Foundation.
Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands. Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands. Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands. Clap your hands now, people, clap now. Clap your hands now, people, clap your hands.
Here's a quick New Orleans fact. Golf course designer Joe Bartholomew was the first African-American inducted into the Greater New Orleans Sports Hall of Fame. He built golf courses in an era when few African-Americans played golf. Bartholomew was a businessman, landscaper, and excavator responsible for designing the Metairie Golf Course and the City Park Golf Course of New Orleans. That's a quick New Orleans fact. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. If you have comments or questions regarding the show, tweet me at Miss Janae Pierre. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to janae@wwno.org. We'll be back with you next week here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.